Ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much indeed for joining us for this last session. Of course, it's International Week all over the world. Meanwhile, Russia 2018 is less than 3 years away. And then, of course, there's Qatar 2022. Firstly, thank you to one of our sponsors from the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy in Qatar, which has responsibility for the organisation of the tournament there, and they have made this session and our guests possible to be here today. Thank you to them. Amidst all the turbulence and claims and counterclaims, it's easy to forget why, exactly why, Qatar was so keen and remains so keen to host what is still the biggest single sporting show on earth. So just remember what it's about.
Bewitching little bit of football from the number 10 of Okocha, completely outfoxing Colling.
Superb technique. I mean, you know, almost having seen it once or twice that he's going to do that, but he does it so well that the defender is drawn to the right side and Kenan can't keep the header down.
Best move of the match so far. Okocha, wrong foot, three defenders there. It does create a clear-cut opening. He does everything to put the ball in the net.
Xavi is just to his right if he wanted to change the angle. It's Mendieta, and that's 2-1 Spain.
This is Owen, taking it in stride. Chabot trying not to bring him down. It's still Michael Owen. He scored a wonderful goal. Is there nothing beyond this 18-year-old? Everyone off the bench. And what a moment for the teenager and for England. From 1-0 to 2-1 up. And still we've played barely quarter of an hour.
So, three of my special guests in that short World Cup video, six World Cups between them, 204 international appearances between them. My maths is getting better. Please welcome JJ Okocha of Nigeria, Gaizka Mendieta of Spain, Michael Owen of England, plus the Assistant Secretary General of Tournament Affairs for the Supreme Committee in Qatar, Nasser Al-Khattar. When you see that, Michael, what do you think? What goes through your mind?
I wish I was that good for longer. No, it was a great moment, obviously, in my career. To do anything in the World Cup, it's where all the eyes of the world are on. A lot of people probably heard of me in this country prior to that France 98 World Cup. But as soon as you perform at a World Cup, then the rest of the world hears about you. And I think that's what I took from that World Cup. It probably announced me to the rest of the world. And, you know, people, when they talk about me or when they meet me for the first time, a lot of the first things they say is that goal against Argentina. So it's what you can be remembered for as well.
Gaizka, what about you? I mean, where do World Cups rate in your memories of your career?
Well, the same. I think as a professional, Champions League could be only at that level when you play the finals or you win it. But the World Cup reaches every single corner of the globe. Wherever you go, people remember you, obviously, for playing for your country, more than for your club. And the World Cup is that scenario where I was lucky to score a goal. I think as a kid, that's something you dream of, not only to play, if I could score a goal in the World Cup. And I was lucky enough to be part of it and score one. Unfortunately, it wasn't the World Cup for us in Spain, the Korea, and was, I think as a nation, we put a lot of enthusiasm and hopes in every tournament because of the quality of players we always had, and never until obviously 2008 could deliver. But every tournament was our new chance to prove that we wanted to be champions.
JJ, where do World Cups rate for you in your career?
Well, I think mine might be a bit different because I was among the first players that qualified Nigeria for the first time for the World Cup. And I never thought that I would play in a World Cup, and being part of that team was something special for me. It's something I still struggle to find words to describe because we were even privileged to watch World Cup on telly.
What's your first memory of the World Cup, of watching a World Cup as a child, maybe?
It was with a few friends, you know, because all we had then was football. We never had PlayStation or whatever, so for us...
How old were you?
I was 7. And for us, we see it as a way of staying out of trouble and having fun. So for us to have the honor to watch it was totally something spectacular for us because we were having a lot of light issues. So we never knew when we were going to get the next light. So it was amazing for us. And then for me to become part of it in the future was something unbelievable for me.
And do you have an outstanding memory of, because you played in the World Cup, firstly in America,
yeah,
and then in France.
And then in Korea, yeah. Japan.
And so what's your outstanding memory?
I think it's the first one, you know, arriving at the airport in America, being welcomed by hundreds of Nigerians, if not thousands, and then the VIP treatment that we got because we're not used to it. So it was amazing just being there, having the experience, seeing the fantastic stadiums was amazing for us.
Do you have an outstanding memory of Japan, Korea, where you played?
Well, the first game, I think, is you've been preparing that World Cup for so long. Practically, our team was similar to the one in the Euro, so it was kind of the time to test ourselves. And you think this is the time it's starting? Are we ready? We want to, you know, to play well and to win. And you have to take it step by step. And the time the first game starts, you get to the stadium, to the dressing room, and you get prepared for that moment which you've been waiting for so long. That's probably the first memory that comes to my head.
And Michael, I mean, you played in 3 World Cups as well?
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with the lads in terms of when you play league football, Premier League football, you've got a game every 3 or 4 days. You look forward to one game and you don't even know who you're playing in a week or two's time. And then all of a sudden that game finishes and you go on to the next game. So it's almost like
roller coaster
of just game after game after game. Whereas the World Cup, you know, the draw comes out and you fix your sights on that first game of the tournament. And for, you know, months, you're looking at that one game and you're getting so worked up, revved up, preparing, training, all for that one first game. So I think the emotions, the coach journey, being in the hotel, the coach journey to the stadium for that first game, you know, it's just, you almost feel like an out-of-body experience. You're so pumped up for this first game. And that's what I remember, you know, almost the coach journey, the anticipation going to the game.
Nasser, are you jealous of these guys? Would you love to have done that?
Well, I'm hoping.
I am.
I'm hoping that I play the next World Cup.
What Prince Ali this morning in this room said that Prince Ali said very clearly that he expects the World Cup to go ahead in 2022 in Qatar. You've got five stadia coming out of the ground at the moment. After all the controversy and the claims and the counterclaims have been, how is the World Cup now viewed in Qatar? Does the local population still want the World Cup?
Absolutely. Look, the negativity and criticism started very long ago, and I'm under no illusion that it's not going to continue in some shape or form, like all other World Cups that also had to face criticism. But I think the ferociousness of the criticism is actually making the local population a lot more resolute about this World Cup to prove the ability and to showcase the country. And I think, with every wave of criticism, people are more determined to make it a more successful World Cup than any other World Cup.
And have there been wobbles, though, along the way? Have you had wobbles along the way when you thought, do I need this in my life?
Look, I think, like any job, it has its challenges and it has its struggles. Yeah, absolutely. My wife also reminds me every now and then and says, do we really need to go through this again? It's taxing. It's tiring sometimes. But at the end of the day, I can't imagine myself doing anything else right now.
Let's talk now about... I was lucky enough, Michael, when you were there, to see behind the scenes. Do you the allegation that's made that it doesn't playing for your country doesn't mean as much anymore to players? Do you recognise that? Do you think it's true?
No, I don't think it's true. I think what's happened is that other competitions throughout the world have almost, with the growth of football and around the world, then there's certain competitions that have got even more spectacular, things like the Champions League, La Liga, the Premier League. There's so many other competitions that focus the mind of players, managers alike. So because there's a lot of attention elsewhere, people tend to think that, that takes away from other aspects. But I can assure you, if you ask any footballer out there, what's the one tournament? If you could only win one tournament in your life, what do you want to win? I mean, the World Cup has to be the number one. It's, you're fortunate if you're born in a country that produces good players and you go to a World Cup with a good chance of winning. So inevitably, a lot of football players, winning a World Cup is pretty impossible. But it still has to be the biggest, the best, the most prestigious competition in the world and has to always remain that.
In Spain, we've talked to you, have these huge clubs, Madrid, Barca. I mean, for some of those great Spanish players, did the World Cup mean more even than a Champions League victory?
I think so. I agree with Michael. I think any player, you ask Iniesta, Xavi, Ramos, Casillas, players that have won absolutely everything. And the World Cup is the competition that is the special because it's not as often as other competitions because that makes it obviously more special because it's nothing as big as a World Cup. And for us as well in Spain, the political sort of thing sometimes takes over the actual sport. And that we say about how the Catalans don't want to play or the Basque. And actually, the national team that has been most successful has been basically Madrid and Barca players. So it does matter for players to be part of the national team because the prestige that it brings to your career and the honour to play for your country. That's nothing similar in a sport.
JJ, when you were away for the World Cup for quite long periods of time, how did you deal with that? I mean, when you were quite a young guy when you went to your first World Cup, What was it like? How did you handle being away from home?
Well, I think I didn't even want to go back home. because it was so wonderful. And of course, you build this relationship with your teammates and they become your family. So it's like being at home. And I think if you ask any footballer that has retired, what we miss the most is the banter in the dressing room, not much of the training or the matches, but the camaraderie that you build with your teammates. So,
but you had quite teenage players, young players, and you could have 30-something-year-old players, much older players. How did they mix together?
Well, I think in my own case, we don't have any issues concerning age difference because it might have something to do with our mentality, with our culture, because most of us are from big families, so we're used to looking after each other. So we never had age difference issues.
Michael, did you since those days, people have written about, you know, the Liverpool clique and the Man U clique in the England team. Were you conscious of that at the time? Or, you know, yes, they used to eat together, but was it more than that?
No, it wasn't more than that, but I think you are conscious of it when you go into... It's mainly in the restaurant when you're going for a meal, and there's an inevitability about it. If you work every single day of every year with the same type of lads, then you're going to naturally sit next to them and talk. So, of course, the majority of time that I was in the international squad, Manchester United were the leading team in the Premier League, so they always had 7-8 players in the squad, and the tables were almost 3 tables of 8 in the restaurant. So you'd have a Manchester United table. And you'd go in and you would notice it, but it wasn't as if they were sort of this is us and the rest at all. It was much more of a, you know, they came down together. What do you expect of them? You know, so people used to make a lot more of it than it actually was. You know, they were all, you know, the lads at the time were all very welcoming and everyone felt part of it as a team. So, but yeah, I think there's no denying that when there are separate tables, that you would generally go and sit next to people that you're most comfortable with.
When Spain got together, did the Real Madrid players sit over there and the Barca players over here?
Yeah, it does happen because it's natural. You've been sharing the dressing room troubles, the bus, eating every time in the hotels with them. So your instinct comes to see with the guys you're sharing. That doesn't mean you don't like the other ones on the other table or, you know, looking because they're Madrid players. In fact, after that, maybe for the coffee, play cards or whatever, PlayStation, you play with the other guys as well. So you interact with all of them. There's a relationship that it gets built, especially when you spend so much time together, which is just what it helps then to the team spirit and on the pitch.
Was boredom ever a problem when Nigeria were playing in a World Cup?
Not at all. I mean, in our own case, it's a lot different because we don't play in the same country. We're all over the world, so we're looking forward to coming back together to see each other again. And for us, it was a lot easier, unlike these guys that are playing at home. I think it has to do with the country that you're playing for. You know, we don't have a strong league at home, so none of us were playing at home. So we're all over, like I said before, all over the world. And then the national team games always give us the opportunity to come together and see each other again.
Michael, we had players who actually suffered from homesickness, didn't they? I mean, there was no doubt that yes, they wanted England to win, but they were quite happy but they were quite happy to be going home.
I think people, you know, when you look at football from the outside, you see what you see. You see the end product, don't you? You watch a football game on the television or at a stadium and you see 90 minutes of football. What you fail to see is the preparation that goes into it, the training every single day, the food every single day, the professionalism, the strictness of your diet, of your timekeeping in terms of going to bed and all these different things. You live a life that is basically, you know, not the norm in many ways. Now, when you go to a tournament, you don't just turn up the morning of a game and then start playing the tournament. You have, you know, you get there, you're a week, you know, you're a few weeks in a different country doing preparation. Then you travel to the country that you're going to play in, you stay there for a week. It sounds very, you know, I don't know what the word is, but it sounds wrong to be complaining about it in any way, shape or form. But there are players that prefer the home comforts. There are players that miss their wife and three, four, whatever they have, children for a month without seeing them. And as I say, it's not a complaint because there's people far, far worse off than a footballer that don't see their parents or father or whatever for years maybe. But it is a fact that to give your best, you need to be mentally right, physically right, ready for the game. And, you know, some people can live away. Like JJ said, some people are just great at mixing and some people are, you know, individual type of people just want to move off to the hotel room and talk on the phone to their partner or whatever and just keep themselves to themselves. And to do that for over a month, and don't forget, that is when the pressure is at its highest. If you play poorly, if you've lost a game or if you're getting criticism from the press or the fans or whatever it might be, it becomes even more lonely and you wander off to your room and it's... you know, yes, there's 90 minutes of a game, and yes, you go down and have breakfast, lunch and dinner with them during the day, but then there's another 12 hours that you've got to try to fill during the day, sitting in your room looking at four white walls for over a month. There's more to it than meets the eye, I think, and you can, you know, you see different characters that respond in different ways.
Did you in Spain, with Spain, experience these sort of issues?
Yeah, the reason I think is... it's difficult because you got the ones that are playing regularly, they go a target. They got, you know, something to improve the games, the tactics sort of chat with everyone. But sometimes the players that are not involved directly, like maybe it's always two or three, they don't play regularly. They play maybe the odd game when you're already qualified. But if you're not lucky enough to be qualified in the second game and all the games are important, you might have three guys that haven't played 1 minute in the whole tournament. And it's not easy for them. Again, like Michael said, it's delicate to explain and put it out to people to understand it. But it can be quite difficult to spend the whole month just trying to be happy and smiley and add it up to the group for the sake of the team, which is, at the end of the day, as we're talking about team spirit. But it takes a lot from players and managers to try to make that long stay easier for everyone.
Nasser, how then is the World Cup of 2022 going to be different from what we've been hearing, from what happened in France and in Japan and Korea and indeed in Germany?
Well, David, I think the two key differences are going to be, are A, that it's going to be played in November and December, which hasn't happened before. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is the proximity of all the venues and the hotels where most of these players are going to be staying. There's nothing that's more than 1 hour away, whether it's from a venue to a hotel or from one venue to the other. It's no longer than 1 hour, which I think is going to be unique, and I think it's going to be welcoming. You don't need to travel from one host city to the other. You don't need to check out from a hotel and check into another hotel. And I think that means that there's more time to focus on football, to focus on training, and to focus on just being as calm and relaxed as possible before a game.
And the training grounds will be identical, yes?
Yes. So and each team will have an identical training camp as the other team.
I mean, what sort of training camp, say, did you have in America? Did you have a good training facilities in America?
Oh, we had a fantastic training facility. But I don't think... if you're in a tournament like that, you're too concerned about where you are. You know, as long as you have a good room to sleep, a good pitch to train, I think the other things are primary. You know, so for us, it's a bit different. Our target is also different from these guys because. The expectations are too high, if I may put it that way, because every World Cup that England is taking part, they expect England to win. Every World Cup that Spain is taking part, people expect Spain to win. But for us, sometimes our target could be just qualifying for the next round. So it's a bit different to compare our own target or our own situation to these guys.
How do you think the players will react to a World Cup in November, December?
I think I agree. I mean, in terms of not have to travel, I think that's quite difficult. After you've played a game 90 minutes and then have to go to the airport quickly, catch the flight, hotel.
So you won't have any of that?
Yeah, I think that's great. That's fantastic for the players, for the coaches. Have that time to use it for watch whatever videos or meetings they would like to be. In terms of recovery, obviously, for the players, it's also even better. There's not so much traveling.
I think it'll also be fantastic for the atmosphere of the World Cup. I mean, I almost look at it like the Olympics. You know, the Olympics in London was such a great event because it feels like everyone's together, that you know, the atmosphere is so good. And when you have, you know, you're flying 3 hours across a country to play to the next game, OK, big countries, everyone gets to see you, but having almost a concentrated group of games, it almost feels as if it would be a big celebration, a big village, just like it was in an Olympic occasion. So I think that's a great benefit that Qatar are obviously offering.
And winter, playing in winter, is this at last England's great chance, as the chairman of the FA seems to think?
Well, I think obviously our players should be reasonably fit by then.
Everybody else's players are going to be pretty fit, aren't they?
I think we're clutching at straws if we think that we're going to win the World Cup because it's in the winter. But I've got no problems at all. And if I was playing now, I'd have no problems at all playing, you know, starting the league season, going away for a World Cup and then finishing the league season. It happens in other leagues. So I've got no problem at all with that. And I don't think the players will as well. And I mean, it's just logical that you play in a country like Qatar when it's a little bit cooler. I don't think there's any problem.
Now, so what's happened to all that cooling technology that you were going to introduce? Is that all gone in the bin now?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's part of the legacy that we promised, and we're still going ahead. You mentioned earlier that 5 stadiums are popping up from the ground. In fact, 1 stadium is going to be complete end of 2016, and it's going to be completed with cooling technology. So far, we have all the stadiums that are under construction are all going to include the cooling technology.
Are you going to fill them? Are you going to fill those stadia with people? I mean, are there going to be enough? Is there going to be enough support, is really what I'm saying.
For the World Cup?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. The World Cup is a competition where no doubt you're going to have the fans. And the other thing I think that we need to remember is geographically Qatar is 4 hours, I think it was, 4 hours from 2 billion people. So I think geographically, I think the reach of some of the world's biggest airlines such as Qatar Airways, Etihad, Emirates make it a very easy destination to get to Qatar. So I think that's also something very important to keep in mind.
And for a turbulent region like the Middle East, does it matter how the Middle East as a whole reacts, whether other nationalities come into Qatar?
Well, I think the fact that right now the Middle East is going through a sensitive time, I think it's really important for a World Cup to take place in the Middle East. And, I mean, it's been a dream of the Middle East. I mean, there was attempts by Egypt, there were attempts by Morocco to host the World Cup. And I think, you know, the fact that Qatar landed the World Cup is an important thing for the pride. And I think it's an important tool for global dialogue. And I think people are going to be quite surprised. A lot of people, I'm sure in this room, travel a lot, but I'm sure there's a lot of people that don't travel, that don't know what it's like in the Middle East, and have grown up looking at the Middle East through the lens of the BBC or CNN, and they will be surprised. And I think it's a great opportunity.
JJ, do you think football should take an opportunity to go to new frontiers and go to new areas, be it the Middle East, be it Australia, wherever?
Well, yes, I think for me personally, there's nothing better than learning different cultures and going to different places, understanding how things work in other parts of the world. And I must say that I had the privilege to play in Qatar. I played there a year. And like he rightly said, a lot of people don't know how it is or how life is in Qatar. It's a fantastic place. And I can understand also people having fears of going to Qatar. The same thing happened when the World Cup was awarded to South Africa. People didn't know what to expect. And at the end of the day, it happened to be one of the best World Cups so far. So I'm quite excited, you know, if I may put it that way, looking forward to something different. World Cup being played in November, December, in the Middle East for the first time, and having the opportunity also to understand how a big event like that will be hosted in Middle East.
Kosko, how damaging do you think the bad publicity has been for this World Cup?
I think like two other many countries that have held a World Cup, there's always been criticisms. Yep. South Africa, Brazil, any country that has had a World Cup has had criticism, where the stadiums weren't finished, the security, social turbulence in the, because the politicians wouldn't do it. Nothing to do really with football. And I think we're talking about obviously football here, and then I think it's a great opportunity for football to go somewhere where it's never been. I think that's one of the priorities of football in general, isn't it? Where you want to get and to reach as many people and football fans in the world as you can.
Michael, will you be envious of those who go to this World Cup?
I think it'll be a fantastic tournament. I mean, it's I've been lucky enough to go to Qatar many times, in fact. They've got some of the most amazing facilities. The hotels are just as good as anywhere in the world. The temperature, obviously, being a winter World Cup, is going to be absolutely fine. The food, everything about it, I don't think there'll be any complaints, put it that way, after the World Cup. I think it'll be a great World Cup, and yeah, I'm quite envious. I'd love to play there.
Now, so what are you going to do about the WAGs in Doha? I always ask that question. Go on. Will they have a good time?
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Very important.
Absolutely. We have some beautiful beaches. We've got great restaurants, great shopping, sightseeing. I mean, I think Qatar in itself is going to have a lot to offer, but I think also the proximity of a lot of beautiful countries nearby also offer an opportunity to explore them at least. So, yeah, they're going to be occupied.
But the important thing is the legacy, our favourite word. What, from your point of view, should be the legacy of the 2022 World Cup?
Well, we can divide it into two parts. We can say the physical legacy or the tangible legacy. I think, you know, cooling technology is an important aspect because it opens the opportunity for other countries who've always taken the weather as a reason for not hosting mega events, be sport events or non-sport events. I think the fact that we recognize early on that we do not need and do not want stadiums that are 40,000 seats or more, and taking that into consideration early on in the design, and being able to contribute these seats to develop sport infrastructure in other countries, I think is also a very important legacy. From the intangible side, like we said earlier, I think seeing the Middle East for what it really is going to be very important. I think the fact that you're going to have fans from all parts of the world in Qatar for 30 days or for however long they're going to be at the tournament, it's I think that's priceless. And also, let's not forget about the social legacy that's ongoing on a day-to-day basis. I think, you know, I mean, it's no secret that there's been a lot of criticism, there's been a lot of dialogue about workers' welfare in the state of Qatar, and I think if it wasn't for the World Cup, there wouldn't have been this accelerated progress, whether it be in laws, in protecting workers, if it's in raising the bar on health and safety. If it wasn't for the World Cup, this could have taken 20 years. But now we're seeing that it's an accelerated process. So I think there's a lot of legacy that's going to be a result of this World Cup.
So, finally, your own countries. JJ, where is Nigerian football at this moment?
I think we're struggling at the moment, but we're on the right path because we just employed a new coach who has been in the World Cup before, so he knows what it means for the nation to be taking part in a World Cup competition. So, and Qatar is a reasonable target for us because we're still 7 years away. So that gives him a lot of chance to build a team that will easily qualify us for the next World Cup. But the truth is, at the moment, we are not the force that we used to be in African football, but we're not too far away.
Racing the trophy, you just want to feel that over and over. At the moment, we obviously focus in the Euros, get back to winning track, and to try to get that team and spirit that we had that it was so successful. So, at the moment, eyes on the Euros, but definitely World Cup is the next step.
Michael, England, what is it? 7 wins out of 7, as it now, and yet the last weekend of the Premier League, was it 22%? English players playing in the Premier League, starting in the Premier League. Why should England do any better in the next European Championship, let alone World Cup in Russia?
Well, they shouldn't in many ways. I mean, we've qualified really well over the last few years, to be honest. We tend to go virtually unbeaten or unbeaten in most qualification campaigns and do it without sweating in recent tournaments, but then got to the tournament, and I think the last two or three have been obviously very, very disappointing. So I think the British public are going to want to see progress in a tournament before they get carried away with an unbeaten qualifying campaign, because we've seen it before. We've seen it in the last two or three tournaments where we've been particularly poor at the tournament but qualified pretty well. So I think when you're looking ahead to Qatar, then who knows what type of players we'll have in our squad. I think there's a lot of good young players in academies up and down the country that I watch on a regular basis. There are talented boys being developed at the moment. So who knows when it gets to Qatar. Obviously the focus at the moment is European Championships and whether we're good enough to compete in that, and inevitably we'll be good enough to compete, but whether we're good enough to go and win it, then that's probably doubtful.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a long but terrific day. I hope you've enjoyed today. Back in this room at 9:45 tomorrow morning, I think there's a session on refereeing, my favourite subject, and Hayley McQueen will be in this chair. Do join her. Thank you very much indeed for your attendance. Thank you.